Chapter 12, A Legend Appears. Stavius was awestruck. Merlin was beyond any doubt Mark's favorite fictional character. Sure, you could make a case for Batman or Spider-Man or possibly Superman if you were old, but none of them matched Merlin. He was the granddaddy of all superheroes. He was the model for Tolkien's Gandalf. This was the greatest moment in Stavius's life. It was better than meeting the gods. It was even better than learning he was going to become a god. After all, Stavius had already met the gods and found them to be disappointing. The only concern in Stavius's mind was that Mark had expected a tall, thin, severe-looking man instead of the plump and jolly guy standing in front of him. He worried that his hero might not meet his high expectations as he began to introduce himself. He was just opening his mouth when the ground shook and the sound of a loud explosion rumbled through the cave. Uriel shouted, "Everybody out! Grab whatever you can! Leave the cave and move away from the entrance!" Then there was a second explosion, much more forceful than the first. Stalactites broke free from the ceiling and crashed to the floor. Toxic gases began seeping from the depths of the cavern. "Run! Run as fast as you can!" screamed Safe as she shooed her children ahead of her. Everyone charged out of the room except for Janice and Stavius. Stavius picked up the ball and instructed Janice to transform the granite sand into a lump of clay. Janice hesitated, but quickly complied after Stavius asked him if he wanted to run through a cave carrying the unprotected crystal ball. The boys ignored the screams from Merlin's projection as it bounced off the walls and ceiling. Stavius placed the ball in the pile of clay and quickly covered it with the soft mud. "Okay, now release your transformation and let's get out of here," he screamed at Janice. The air was almost unbreathable. Janice waved his hand and the clay resumed its granite form. Stavius picked up the ball and handed it to Janice, who dropped it into his rucksack. They ran for the entrance as fast as they could. The rucksack bounced and bobbled as they ran, and the boys heard a tiny voice emanating from the pack yelling phrases like,
"Hey, watch out! Let me out of here! I can't see a thing! Ouch! Oh no, I'm going to puke!"
They were halfway to the entrance when they heard two terrifying roars and a high-pitched woman's shriek. Mars passed them running back into the cave yelling, "Venus, my love, I'm coming to save you!" The boys collapsed outside the cave entrance, coughing and sputtering from the noxious fumes. The girls dragged them to a safer distance as the oily brown gases became darker and more toxic. Several minutes passed until Mars finally stumbled out carrying a limp and naked form. It was the remains of Venus. "Quick, set up the tent and get some heating stones," yelled Elisa, but Ops was already unpacking the tent and Janice held two glowing enchanted rocks in his hands. Mars wept, "Please save her," as he placed the unmoving form in the tent and backed out. Elisa and Ops crawled in to see what they could do. Venus was an ageless, eternal, ethereal being, so she should not be affected by any physical toxin. The Soul Reaper body she had inhabited, however, seemed to be withered, with massive grooves and ridges everywhere. It was still alive, but shivering and chattering. Ops moved the stones closer to the body, and it softly moaned, "Thank you." 10 minutes later, the woman and girl backed out of the warming tent and closed the flap. Everyone was anxiously waiting outside for news. "Will she live? Will she recover from being disfigured by that toxic gas?" croaked Mars between sobs. "I believe that both Venus and the Soul Reaper body she has been using will be just fine," chuckled Ops. "I don't think the gas did any damage, but sitting in the hot tub for nearly 3 weeks has turned her into a living raisin. Let's find her some clothes and build a dry sauna with some heating stones. She should stay out of the water for a few days and limit her soaks in the future." Everyone relaxed, and Versera turned to ask Uriel what had just happened. "Was it an earthquake? A volcanic eruption? Is hot lava going to start flowing out of the cave?"
"No, child, nothing so dramatic," chuckled Uriel. "Older dragons tend to pass gas when they awaken, which can be quite forceful if they've been in a trance for an extended time. Those eruptions, as you describe them, were monstrous farts from my two ancestors waking up. I believe that opening Merlin's crystal ball has roused both my mother and my grandmother. I can't believe that Grandma's still alive. It's a good thing I dusted them both right before the reunion.
She turned toward her granddaughters and commanded,
Girls, go get as much food as you can. Your great-grandmothers will be starving, but they won't be able to eat anything large. Bring back some ribbits and deer. Oh, and squirrels. Bring back as many squirrels as you can. Your great-great-grandmother loves the way their tails pop when they're swallowed.
The remaining humans and dragons waited outside for at least 15 minutes until Uriel gave the all-clear signal. She explained that it was safe to return to the cave, but that the place would stink and groaned how it would take weeks to clean everything inside, including the walls, floor, and ceiling. Janice hefted his rucksack on his shoulder and heard muted grunts, complaints, and swearing from inside. They had forgotten entirely about Merlin during the confusion. Both he and Stavius desperately wanted to meet their hero and to learn his secrets, but they were dreading letting him out. Let's leave him in there until things settle down, suggested Stavius. Good idea, Janice said in agreement.
No, no, it is not a good idea. Let me out of here right now, you two imbeciles,
squeaked a tiny, muffled voice.
Safe busily readied the cave for the elders while Uriel trotted to the rearmost chambers to greet them. Everyone was struggling to not breathe through their noses. The child dragons were disappearing and reappearing with small game. Juice and the other dragon men were nervously inspecting their man cave garden for damage. Juice explained that the new sprouts were at a very delicate stage of their development. And the seven humans returned to their room with Merlin's crystal ball. Janice set the ball on the floor and transformed the granite into a pile of sand. A very annoyed and animated wizard sprang forth and began yelling,
Don't you ever do that again! That was absolutely inexcusable behavior! If I were still corporeal, I would smite you with a blast of magical energy more powerful than you could possibly imagine!
But you aren't corporeal, said Narayana. And I've never had anyone threaten to smite me before, laughed Versera. Oh, we smite people all the time in our fantasy war games, said Stavius.
You are such hopeless geeks, groaned Narayana. Hey, you're missing the point. This is all about me, bellowed Merlin. I cannot believe the lack of respect from this group.
Well, you are little more than a 3D movie, noted Terra.
What is 3D and what is a movie? Asked Merlin.
Then he added, Never mind. I just want to know why you wrapped me up, threw me in a bag, and bounced me all over creation.
Because we didn't want to break the crystal ball. Uriel's mother and grandmother just woke up and blasted the entire place with toxic gas. We wrapped your orb up in granite to protect you while pulling you from the danger zone, exclaimed Janice.
And it never occurred to you that a magic crystal ball capable of containing a person's consciousness wouldn't have a protective shield around it? Queried Merlin.
Well, no. But that does make sense, mumbled Janice. Of course it makes sense, you idiot, complained Merlin.
Stavius came to Janice's defense with,
But we didn't know that. We didn't want to risk damaging you if the shield wasn't active after being discharged for so long.
A little jostling seems like a small price to pay for us ensuring that you're all right.
Yeah, so suck it up and stop whining, added Narayana.
I have no idea what you mean by suck it up, but I do not like your tone, young lady. I am, however, grateful for your consideration of my well-being. I thank you for your care, and I withdraw my comment about you being idiots. But please, never do that again. I suffer from terrible motion sickness, the wizard admitted. This was not at all how Mark had wanted to meet his hero. He said, It is such an honor to meet you, Merlin. I've read everything about you. Merlin was taken back by this admission. You've heard of me? But you must be from at least the year 1800 back in Albion. Narayana asked, Where is Albion?
Saturn replied with obvious disdain, Albion is what this gentleman would have called the land in which he lived. We would call that island Britain today, but I think it would be clearer to refer to the entire world, which we call Earth.
Terra spoke, Okay, well, we're from a few hundred years later than that, but how did you know? Merlin was clearly impressed and answered, "Earth is an odd name for the world, but I will use it henceforth. The prophecy obviously has a cycle of just over 1,200 years. Our cycle was over, and I simply did the math. But you say they're still talking about me nearly 1,000 years after I died? I obviously didn't give Jeff enough credit." Saturn piped up, "Do you mean that you spoke with Geoffrey of Monmouth, the author of the Arthurian Tales?" Merlin grinned. "Yes, well, he was just a kid at the time and certainly didn't have any of Monmouth title, but that was the guy. Wait, did you say Arthurian Tales?" Saturn explained, "Geoffrey of Monmouth is known for the stories he wrote about the mythical King Arthur. Most readers become enthralled about Camelot with its gleaming alabaster walls, the round table, the tales of knights in shining armor on their quest for the Holy Grail, and, of course, the sword and the stone. Historians, however, recognize most of this as fiction. However, many believe that some of the stories are based upon actual people and events from that era. We call it the Dark Ages because we know so little about that period in England and Europe. It would be immensely beneficial to our understanding of this era if you do indeed possess the memories of someone who lived during it. And don't forget tournaments with jousting, King Arthur's glorious battles, and the sorcerers, magicians, and dragons," Stavius quickly added. "The stories say that you were King Arthur's court magician. Is that true?" "Court magician? Arthur a king? Knights with shiny armor? What did that hack write? I hired that imbecile to write my memoirs. All those stories of which you speak were background material. I should never have paid him in advance," grumbled Merlin. He sat on a rock and sulked. Saturn quickly mentioned that Geoffrey's first writing was, in fact, called Prophecies of Merlin, and he also wrote another work titled Life of Merlin. His most broadly known book was, however, The History of the Kings of Britain, in which he discussed King Arthur in great detail. The history teacher side of Saturn was entirely in control now. He continued, "We know that many elements, like Arthur, dragons, and your living for 400 years, were added to bring interest to the story. Learning the details of the historical elements would be invaluable. What can you tell us about what really occurred?" Janice interrupted and said, "That sounds like a fascinating conversation, but I think it can wait. The more compelling questions involve how you acquired all 7 talismans, what you did with them, why it worked, and why it didn't fulfill the prophecy." Narayana agreed. "I was going to say the same thing. Let's not lose focus now." Saturn relented. "Of course, of course. We can discuss all this later. Please help us with understanding our mission." Merlin turned around to face his audience. He studied their faces and saw curiosity, amazement, and excitement. It had been a very long time since he had entertained an eager audience. He said, "Very well, I will tell you about the talismans, but first I need to clarify some of your information. You need to know who I am and a little about my compatriots before we begin. First, let me retract my disparagement of Jeff. I did hire him to write about me. However, he worked for the church, and I am not surprised that he could only get his works published by packaging them as stories about spreading Christianity. His employers certainly weren't going to promote a story about a wizard. The short answers to some of your questions are that both Arty and Camelot certainly existed, although Camelot was not a kingdom and Arty never claimed to be a king. Camelot was, however, magnificent, with tall, pure white alabaster walls which gleamed so brightly in the sunlight that any attacking armies would be blinded. Of course, that would have been more useful had we lived in a part of the world where the sun shone regularly, but it was still pretty. Yes, we did use a round table for our meetings, but the people sitting at it were the 7 major Britain kings at the time, and, of course, Arty. There were no knights nor shiny armor. The kings provided Arty with a defensive army, but the soldiers wore heavy leather and occasionally chainmail. Arty did yank out a sword jammed in a large rock. That's another great story I could tell you over a pint. Hey, I wonder if I can still enjoy a tasty brew as a ghost. He sighed when he realized the answer to his question.
There was obviously magic on, what do you call Albion now? Oh yes, there was magic on Earth, and many who practiced it. But Morgana, Anna, Vivian, and I were the only true sorcerers of the time. and I was far more than Artie's court magician," Merlin concluded with a snort.
The old wizard glared at Stavius for a few moments before his face softened, and he said, "And I can explain about the misunderstanding concerning my age." Merlin looked guilty but sighed and said, "It's no big deal. So I shaved a few years off my age. It's not a crime. Everybody does it. You see, there was a woman involved. Well, there were several, but that's not important." His audience gaped in silence until Saturn finally asked, "How old were you?"
Merlin closed his eyes and calculated for a moment before replying, "I suppose I must have died shortly after my last visit to Avalon, which was in 1134. I hadn't been feeling well for quite some time and had this nasty flu I couldn't shake. Let me see. My host, Myrdan Wilt, was born in 468, so I suppose I would have been 666 years old, which is a rather inauspicious age, is it not? Now, to be precise, Merlin didn't really exist before I jumped through that air hole. What do you call Albion now? Oh, yes, I didn't go through the opening to Earth and become Merlin until 507, so you could say that Merlin was only 627. Still, either way makes me seem awfully old, doesn't it? I never really felt over 200 until that last cold. It just sucked the energy right out of me."
Merlin looked sad, as though his last comments had reminded him that he was dead. Tara felt terrible for the old man and would have put her arm around him if he had a physical form. Instead, she looked at him and nodded in understanding, although there was no way she could possibly empathize with what he must be feeling. The old wizard brightened a bit and said, "But enough about me. You want to know how we captured the 7 talismans and built the magical engine. Those are fun stories, but first, you mentioned something about a quest for a grail. What is that?" Stavius quickly answered. He felt as though he needed to redeem himself after calling his hero Arthur's court magician. He confidently said, "The Arthurian legend speaks of Arthur's quest to find the chalice Jesus used at his Last Supper. It is supposed to grant eternal life and is known as the Holy Grail."
Merlin's face was frozen in shock for what seemed like several minutes. Then a grin appeared, and he began laughing. He sat down, rolled on his back, and was almost having a seizure from laughing so hard. The old man finally calmed enough to sit up after 2 or 3 minutes. Then he saw Stavius's concerned expression and collapsed in another laughing fit.
The people in the room kept glancing at each other, wondering whether anyone knew what was so funny. It became evident that no one did, so they sat back to wait for this strange old man to finish. Merlin managed to get himself under control and to retain his composure even after seeing Stavius again. The contortions on his face indicated that this was apparently a struggle for him. Still, he was ready to speak after a few minutes of silence and several hard swallows. "Young man," he hoarsely croaked out, "you are indeed correct that Artie sent many of his personal guards to search for something throughout all of Britain. You correctly surmised that he believed that this object would bring him infinite power and eternal life. However, I assure you that the Lord Jesus Christ's lips never touched this vessel." Merlin paused to swallow a chuckle that threatened to escape from his mouth. The wild look in his eyes indicated that he knew he would be in the throes of another laughing fit if a giggle escaped his lips. He held his breath for a few more moments until the urge had entirely passed. He held up a finger and said, "I promise I will explain Artie's quest at a later time, but I should discuss the talismans before the stern young lady over there chastises me again. First, I have a request. You now know about me. May I please request the honor of making your acquaintance before I begin?"